People are increasingly concerned about the stuff in food that is not necessarily food. Witness the fact that even McDonald's is working towards serving chicken that is nearly all antibiotic-free. And it is chicken we will talk about in this hour. Chicken made bigger by the use of antibiotics, chicken consumption made bigger by marketing, and a chicken industry now with the power to defeat intents to regulate it. These are the subject of Maren McKenna's book, Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. Maren McKenna focuses on food policy and public health in her work as a journalist. She's written works for National Geographic, Atlantic, and Slate, among others. Her highly viewed TED Talk from 2 years ago was called What Do We Do When Antibiotics Don't Work Anymore? Maren McKenna, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
So people were asking that question more than 2 years ago about why, what do we do when antibiotics don't work anymore. Given that we've been asking the question for this long, why is it taking so long to get it out of food?
Yeah, it's a really good question. This has been a long battle. You know, I think that maybe just in the past couple of years, people may have gotten, may have started to notice that antibiotics are a routine component of how we raise meat animals. But the reality is that this practice goes back to the earliest days of the antibiotic era, to the late 1940s. And really, we've been fighting it in this country at least since the 1970s and only kind of got traction on it in the past couple of months. As to why that is, you know, partly it's people not wanting to look too closely at the issue, partly it's inertia, and a lot of it was political and economic pressure from the industry and from some political interest to keep things the way they always were.
We'll visit this again later in more specific detail, but I was amazed at the fact that we were talking 40 years ago that somebody said it's time to regulate antibiotic use in the poultry industry. The power of the industry was such that it didn't happen.
It's a completely lost story to most people, and it was really astounding to me. So again, you know, this starts in the late 1940s, right at the start of the antibiotic era, that people start giving tiny doses of antibiotics to meat animals routinely. And the book's called Big Chicken, and it's centered around chicken because chickens were the first animals to get these growth promoter antibiotics experimentally. Chicken essentially taught the rest of intensive livestock production how to use and misuse antibiotics. And it became clear by the 1960s that though this had the upside of creating protein that was could be produced very quickly and was very, very cheap, it also created drug-resistant bacteria that moved out from the animals and caused outbreaks in people even very far from farms. And so Europe began to regulate this in the late 1960s. And in 1977, when the Carter administration had just come in with a crew of very earnest young reformers that wanted to change Washington, Carter's FDA tried to stop this practice by yanking the licenses they'd given to companies to dispense antibiotics in this way back in the 1950s, and political interference in the form of highly placed congressmen with big agricultural backers made it impossible to go forward, and the situation stayed in that stalemate for more than 30 years.
Well, and so we're in a world now where people actually are thinking a little harder about this. So you mentioned Europe first, and the first story in the book is your story in Paris eating a poulet crapaudin. Is that what it's called?
Your accent is very good. Yes, that's exactly right.
Why the dish so amazing, and why did it ultimately make you sad to get such a great thing?
So I do a lot of work in Europe as a journalist, and like anyone, you know, I love going to Europe. And one day I was there, and I wandered up to a street market, the kind of street market that Parisians buy their food at every day of the week. And in the middle of this market was this booth where there was a giant sort of portable cabinet where they'd been roasting chickens all day. And I got one, and a poulet crapaudine. So crapaudine is what we would call spatchcock. It's where you cut the backbone out of a chicken and you flatten it, and it roasts more quickly, and it's very exposed to the heat. And it's called crapaudine because the word for toad, which is what the chicken looks like when it's flattened, sort of the outline of a toad, is the word for toad is crapo. So I bought one of these, and it was incredibly delicious. And after I finished reveling in it, I realized that I'd never really had a chicken in the rest of my life that tasted like this, not only just that it was salty and peppery and had wonderful herbs and garlic and things like that, but that it tasted like the flesh tasted like something. And this sent me on a journey to understand why American chicken, so abundant that it's the thing, the protein we eat more than any other, so cheap that when you account for inflation, its price really hasn't changed very much in decades. Why didn't it taste any better? And that question led me into this whole journey into how we used antibiotics to create a meat production system in which we elevated values like efficiency and consistency and inexpensiveness, and we completely forgot about flavor. And that journey is what led me into writing this book.
I'm reminded of the story of tomatoes at the same time. I mean, the idea is not so much that they have flavor, but that they travel well.
That's exactly right. And, you know, if you've ever grown tomatoes yourself or bought tomatoes at a farmer's market, you're familiar with how fragile they are when they're really ripe and perfect to eat. Well, you know, it's very unusual to find a tomato in a standard supermarket that you have to treat with such care. They have the consistency of softballs, and they were deliberately bred in order to be shippable. And, you know, from the tomato fields through often, you know, days of or weeks sometimes of transport in big trucks and lots of handling and so forth. And in that process of breeding a tomato that could withstand transport, we completely forgot to breed in flavor. And it's very similar with chicken. You know, over all the changes that, in my view, this routine antibiotic use brought to our meat production, one of the things we took away was flavor.
We'll talk more about how we've lost flavor in the pursuit of getting bigger chickens in a hurry and gotten them through antibiotics, how we made chicken a staple of our diet through marketing, and how in the process the bee industry got big and powerful enough to shake off regulation for a very long time. The book is called Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. Maren McKenna is our guest on The Exchange. She wrote it. We'll come back and talk more with her and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the journalist Maren McKenna, who's written a big book but a fast read about poultry and our consumption of it and what we've been taking in all these years. The book is called Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. Share stories about ways you've tried to change your own diet or your awareness of this issue. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You detail a salmonella outbreak early in the book, notable because doctors were noticing the resistance to antibiotics that the strain of salmonella was displaying. You mention in the book, too, that you live very close to the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. So are people there convinced that there's a huge outbreak inevitable?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, there have been huge outbreaks, and I think most people haven't noticed them. The one that you mentioned will be really familiar, I think, to your listeners, because it was up and down the West Coast in 2013 and 2014. It was a drug-resistant salmonella outbreak centered on a California-based chicken producer called Foster Farms. That eventually, over the course of more than a year, took in more than 600 victims in 30 states and territories. And the CDC has a kind of multiplier for foodborne illness, which is that they assume that for every case that's identified and diagnosed, there's probably at least 30 more that go unrecognized, which means this outbreak could have had thousands of victims. And outbreaks like that happen because our food system is both more concentrated and more diverse. That is, there are fewer bigger companies sending product over much longer, thinner lines of distribution. That's how this particular outbreak got to 30 states and territories. And so antibiotic use in one place, creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria, can spread that problem across a really wide scale before we catch up to it.
Maren, does any scientist you've talked to have a feel, though, for how much of antibiotic resistance comes through the chicken we eat versus what comes through the antibiotics we take directly?
Mm-hmm. So this is a really knotty question, and you will hear people say that the only sector that's responsible for antibiotic resistance is medicine. And it's absolutely true that there is overuse and misuse of antibiotics in medicine that causes antibiotic resistance. But it's really a both-and problem. Now, why can't we quantify it? The main reason is because we don't have data that's as good as we ought to, good as, for instance, exists in Europe. And that's, again, going back to that political opposition that we talked about just a few minutes ago, that there have been real blockages to the federal agencies for getting the data they need to attribute exact percentages. However, all of that said, as molecular tools in laboratories get better and better, it's easier and easier to associate the cases in outbreaks to the distribution from companies and even to the, you know, the specific organisms and the specific drugs they're responding to. So there's no question that an agricultural use of antibiotics plays a role in the overall epidemic of resistance, which kills 23,000 Americans a year.
So let's come to the central question on the farm then. What is the output at the farm that requires the input of antibiotics?
Right. So this takes a couple of steps, so stay with me. So the ways we give antibiotics to livestock, to things that are, to meat animals that are going to become the meat we eat, are three. The one that no one disagrees with is giving antibiotics in what's called a therapeutic dose to cure an infection. That's the way we take antibiotics in humans. Then there are these other two uses that date back to the 1940s, which is subtherapeutic antibiotics, also known as growth promoters, which make animals put on weight more rapidly, or grow to the same slaughter weight while getting less feed. And then there's a slightly larger dose, generally known as preventive or prophylactic, but still not big enough to cure an infection, which keeps animals from getting infections in the crowded barns or feedlots that they're held in. In any of those cases, whether it's growth promoters or prevention, the animals are taking the drugs in their feed and water. And so the drugs go into their guts, they affect the bacteria that live in the guts of the animals and the guts of every living thing, even you and me, and they exit the animals as resistant bacteria, either in their manure, which gets into the environment and is widely distributed, or as sort of gut contents when the animal is disassembled, onto the meat that the animals become that then go into home and restaurant kitchens.
So we could test our food and find antibiotics in it, potentially?
No, we've antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So this is an important nuance. So there are some tests. There's federal data under a system, the acronym for which is NARMS, N-A-R-M-S, which looks for and finds antibiotic-resistant bacteria on retail meat in the United States every year. It's a joint project of the CDC, FDA, and the USDA. But the nuance here is that what's on the meat and is not active antibiotic. That is, it's not residue of antibiotics. That's federally regulated, and it's really unusual. The problem is the bacteria that's become resistant, that's in the animal's guts, that then moves toward us via meat or through various environmental pathways and causes a resistant infection. You do sometimes see some producers saying, oh, well, there's no antibiotic on the meat because the federal government will let us, so everything is fine. But the problem has never been residue. The problem is the bacteria that results.
That's a very important point. Thanks for bringing that clear. Maren McKenna is our guest in the exchange. Her book is Big Chicken. You know, on some levels, Maren, this begins to sound like the story of Fritz Haber, the German scientist who developed fertilizer technology to feed billions of people, but he also developed poison gas that could kill millions of people.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. Thank you for mentioning it. Yeah, you know, I often think as a journalist that my beat is sort of unintended consequences. That there are things that people did at the time that seemed like they were a great idea, that they were in various ways going to save the world, that turned out to really have a dark side. And that's certainly the case here, because this use of growth promoter antibiotics, which was originally developed by a biologist who was working for one of the first manufacturers of antibiotics back in the 1940s, it arose out of a desire to feed the world with inexpensive protein after the system of food production had really been devastated by World War II. And the chap who came up with this, this biologist, Thomas Jukes, who lived until the 1990s, to the end of his life, he defended his invention as being a thing that was an unqualified good, and he really refused to see any downside, even as the international epidemic of drug-resistant infections, partly attributed to farm use, was growing and growing.
And this is literally laboratories in the 1940s. So they were just trying to make the chickens healthier? It wasn't anything about trying to make them grow bigger?
No. What they were doing from the start was trying to make them grow bigger.
Okay.
And so the point was that during, if you think back to World War II or kind of imagine World War II, there were millions of soldiers all over the world who needed to be fed. And so the government provided a guaranteed market for all the protein that the United States was producing, or for much of it. And so there was lots and lots of infrastructure sort of spooled up to produce more meat animals and get them out into the field. And then the war ends, and all of that guaranteed market goes away. And in order to keep the industry from crashing, all of a sudden there's a lot of pressure in poultry and cattle and pigs to cut expenses. And so they start feeding animals much cheaper feed, but the animals don't do very well on cheaper feed. And so then there's a search for cheaper supplements to add to the feed to bring back the level of production that they previously had. And out of that comes this biologist in the 1940s who tries a whole bunch of supplements on chicken feed, things like cod liver oil and distiller's grains and crystalline vitamins. And he also tries the leftovers from manufacturing the antibiotic that his company makes outside New York City, a company called Letterly Laboratories, making the first tetracycline drug, chlortetracycline, also known as oreomycin. And the chicks he gives the oreomycin leftovers to grow much bigger than any of the other chicks. And so suddenly here's the answer to this devastated food system is cheap feed with a supplement that was literally going to be thrown away that solves the problem of producing protein more quickly. And out of that, in my view, we get the entire food production system that we have today, in which we move animals through in a very high throughput manner, in which we think of them kind of like widgets more than like individual animals, in which, again, things are very efficient, very consistent. There's almost more protein than we can eat. The prices are very, very cheap, but there are a lot of things we lost along the way.
Maren McKenna is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Give us your thoughts about the kinds of things you're willing to put in your body and your knowledge of things like antibiotics in chicken and other proteins. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Questions and comments can be sent to email as well, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's pause here a second. Do we grow bigger and stronger because of taking antibiotics?
So this is actually a really active area of research right now. Back in the 1950s, when this growth promotion effect was first recognized, the experimenters did do some experiments in human populations, in groups that for various reasons were not able to say no. We would think of these with a great deal of distaste these days, because they were things like disabled children who are held in institutions, or children in very low-income companies. In one case, naval recruits at a Navy base, and they were all given low doses of antibiotics, and they all had, you know, the appropriate result. They all got bigger and stronger. There's actually a lab at New York University right now that's working on this question. And in mice, they have shown that the kind of antibiotics doses that we would take either when we're small children for ear infections, say, or the kind of antibiotic doses that we might inadvertently get because there's some raw antibiotic in our environment from hospital effluent, manufacturing effluent, even farm effluent, that might be changing how we take up nutrition. It might be one of the reasons for our obesity epidemic.
So I know you're not a chemist, and I guess I don't want to get too overly scientific, but do we get bigger because we're just less sickly, or is there something more chemical about the way that antibiotics interact with the body and make us take up nutrition?
So back when they started this, they actually did do some experiments to try to figure out what was going on, but they didn't have the molecular tools. They had a bunch of hypotheses. It's pretty clear now that what goes on, if people, you know, have heard of this concept of the microbiome, the sense that we are surrounded by, coated with, and occupied in our internal spaces by complex communities of bacteria that we live in relationship with. When we take when we give these low doses of antibiotics to farm animals, what we're doing is affecting the mix of bacteria in their gut microbiome in such a way that it changes the way that they take up nutrition. So it's not specifically that they have, say, an infection that no one's noticed that's kind of depressing their metabolisms, and it's not that it's changing them physically in the sense of, like, changing the architecture of their guts, but it's changing the way their nutrition is absorbed.
So the multiplier was one of the things in the book that really surprised me. How many times human consumption of antibiotics is going on American farms?
This is the thing, actually, that aside from my experience with that Parisian chicken, that really made me want to do this book. Because in a previous book, I had looked at the impact of antibiotic resistance on people and was really shocked at the way in which we seem to be losing the antibiotic miracle and the really dreadful infections and deaths that result. There are a lot of dead children in that book. And in the process, I ran across this statistic that in the United States, between 70 and 80% of the antibiotics that are sold every year go for farm animals, not for humans. That is, 3 to 4 times as many antibiotics are given to animals, and almost none of those animals are sick. Those drugs are being given for reasons that are not to cure infections, which in a human we would consider completely inappropriate. And having come out of this milieu where I was listening to, you know, victims of resistance and the families of people who didn't survive and researchers and doctors saying, antibiotics are precious. We have to protect them. We have to use them very conservatively. And then discovering that people could buy them literally by the bucketful at a farm store and never account to anyone for them, which is a practice that was true in the United States up until just this past January, that was stunning to me.
And what changed this past January?
So we talked about how back in the 1970s, the Carter administration tried to place some controls on farm antibiotic use, controls that already were starting to be enacted in Europe, and was beaten back because of political opposition. So that started a stalemate between the federal agencies and the veterinary, pharma, and agriculture industries that lasted really until the Obama administration. And for a complex set of reasons that we can talk about if we have time, the Obama administration decided it was time to tackle this again. And so Obama's FDA went forward with a plan not so much to do legislation or regulation, because Congress could interfere with that, but to put forth a set of what are called guidances, which are rules that only exist within the FDA's purview, that would ask the manufacturers of farm drugs, so the supply side, not the demand side of farmers, to change the labels on their drugs in such a way that it would no longer be legal to use the drugs as growth promoters. And somewhat to everyone's shock, almost every company operating in the United States agreed to this. One company dropped out of the market, and the other 26 all agreed to change their labels. So from January of this year, which is when the rules went into final effect, growth promoter antibiotic use has been illegal in the United States. Now, the problem with that is that that doesn't account for all antibiotic use. There's still that vast category of prevention to keep birds and cattle and pigs in crowded barns and feedlots from being infected by each other. That hasn't been affected by the rules, and it's really questionable as a result, how well these rules are going to work.
Maren McKenna, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. So you mentioned Thomas Jukes, who worked at Lederle Laboratories, did live long enough to see the controversy and was completely unapologetic about it, thought that antibiotics had done great things for the world. Alexander Fleming himself, though, who helped develop penicillin, what did he say about antibiotic use and the way he saw it being used later in his life?
You know, this is so odd, because as you say, Alexander Fleming, the father of penicillin, the person who in 1928, you know, leaves a window open in his laboratory in London and something blows in and kills the bacteria that he's working on, and he realizes that what's blown onto his plates is penicillium mold, and from that he gets the first penicillin. In 1945, he gets the Nobel Prize in Medicine with his collaborators, and he warns that the antibiotic miracle is precious, that if we misuse antibiotics or if we underdose ourselves with antibiotics, then antibiotic bacteria will result and will take away the drug's power. This is 3 years before Jukes does his experiment, and it's a statement, a warning that's very widely covered in the world because, of course, the Nobel Prize. And yet, no one seems to take it sufficiently seriously, because time and time again, in medicine as well as in antibiotics, we have gotten out in front of the power of antibiotics and created resistant bacteria in such a way that we've had to come up with new antibiotics to counter that. The problem now is we're running out of antibiotics. Companies don't want to make them anymore, and therefore we're getting to the end of our power to control the resistant bugs.
Is there, and I noticed one of the antibiotics mentioned in the book, I looked at McDonald's stuff just this morning about some of the ways in which they'll continue to use one particular antibiotic, colistin, is mentioned in the book. What's that got going for it?
Yeah, this is a really sad and difficult story, and people should be worried about this. So one of the problems with where we are in this endless game of leapfrog between bugs and drugs is, as I just said, that pharma companies don't really want to make new antibiotics anymore. They're very expensive to make, they take a long time, and because of the inevitability of resistance, they may not make back all the research and development investment that they have made to bring that new drug forward. So medicine has been turning increasingly to drugs that have been around for a very long time. And this drug colistin, which is a very powerful antibiotic, kind of a last resort antibiotic that you use when everything else doesn't work, actually dates back to the early 1950s and didn't get used for decades because it's a really rough drug to take. It has a lot of side effects. But agriculture picked it up, and resistance was generated while they were ignoring it, and now it's come back to bite us.
So there's resistance to colistin now, too?
Found in China in 2015 and now has spread across the world in people, in animals, and in the meat that the animals become, including here in the United States.
Wow. Tales of larger feed animals and the larger resistance to antibiotics come together in the book Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. We'll come back and talk more with the author, Maren McKenna. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we come back in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about chicken, how much of it we eat and how much more of it we eat than we used to, and how much of it until very recently had bacteria on it that was resistant to antibiotics because the antibiotics that were fed to the animals to make them grow bigger and stronger. So the animals got bigger, the industry got bigger through marketing, and resulted in Big Chicken, which is the title of Maren McKenna's book, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. Big Chicken, the title. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Questions, comments about food safety, about antibiotics, the whole gamut here. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So we've dealt pretty conclusively with the chickens getting bigger. Now let's talk about the consumption getting bigger. This is sort of like Chick-fil-A's slogan, which I noticed you mentioned in the book too. How could you not? Eat more chicken. How did the poultry industry get people to start thinking of chicken differently and buying more of it?
You know, interesting history. I mean, I didn't expect for it to be so interesting when I dove into this, but because of a rolling series of innovations, of which antibiotics are among the chief ones, there are times in from after even before World War II up to now, where supply of chicken gets way out in front of demand for chicken, and the chicken industry, the poultry industry, has to think of things to do to make people want to buy and eat more chicken. And probably my favorite story in this is the story of the Chicken of Tomorrow contest, which took place between 1948 and the early 1950s, which created chicken as we know it today, the big-breasted, white-feathered, docile chickens that are content to just sit in the big, long barns that they are raised in. Chickens didn't used to look like that and didn't used to behave like that, but they were rebred as part of this contest sponsored by the USDA and a major supermarket chain to be birds that had, as they described them at the time, breasts you could slice like a steak. And even that wasn't quite enough because they still were, you know, big chickens. They were birds that were whole and you had to do something with. And so the person who really convinces us to eat more chicken after that is the inventor of the chicken nugget, who are not, in fact, McDonald's, but a Cornell professor who in 1963, as part of coming up with ways to persuade people to buy more chicken, has the idea to take chicken off the bone and make things out of it, and makes all the things we would recognize in a supermarket today, chicken hot dogs, chicken cold cuts, and an invention that he calls the chicken stick, which is the basis of the idea of the chicken nugget that comes out a decade later.
The chicken stick. I can see why they went for chicken nugget instead of that, sure.
Exactly.
So Maren, how much chicken do each of us eat now compared to 50 or 60 years ago?
Oh, it's absurd. We, in the United States, averaged across every man, woman, and child, we eat more than 90 pounds of chicken a year. And chicken has been rising in consumption since 1977, which is when the government first told us that we should eat less saturated fat, which many, many people interpreted as a command to eat less red meat. So chicken became the protein that we thought of as being safe and healthy. And now, now we each eat at least the equivalent of at least one serving of chicken every single day of our lives.
So I have to wonder then if the things we're trying to, the bugs and drugs as the arms race you mentioned here, and if the bugs get used to the drugs after a while, did the antibiotics always work on the chickens the same way? Could you keep giving the same flocks of chickens the same antibiotics and have the same growth results over time?
Well, that's a really good question, because in fact, in the United States, the poultry industry has started to turn away from antibiotic use, and it's a really lovely kind of bracketing of this history, because chickens, of course, started this by being the first ones to get growth promoters, and chickens kind of taught the rest of meat agriculture how to misuse antibiotics. But partly because of those Obama administration rules, and I think mostly because of consumer pressure over the past couple of years, the poultry companies, led by the company Purdue, the fourth largest chicken company in the U.S., they have turned against routine antibiotic use. And partly it's probably because the drugs don't work anymore as well as they used to. And partly it's because the companies undertook some private research, much of which isn't published, but some of which is, that showed them that they really didn't need to use the drugs in the way that they had, because it seems like the drugs kind of filled in deficits in farming as it was conducted in the 50s and 60s, when things were a little simpler, a little dirtier, a little less technological. And now all those deficits have been filled in, and the drugs no longer do what they used to do, and so the companies felt comfortable in giving them up.
Did the big chicken resistance come to resemble the big tobacco resistance to the complaints about its product?
Yeah, I really think, thank you for that question. I think the battle over farm antibiotic use, which is by no means over, even with these Obama administration rules, because there's still such a large percentage of antibiotic use still going on in the United States in farm animals. As I look at it, it reminds me so much of what people said over the battle over tobacco, that for decades, while people knew that tobacco use was clearly causing cancers, the tobacco industry kept saying, no clear effect, more research needed. And even at the beginning of the Obama administration in 2009, the major production groups in this country who represent pork and cattle and even chicken were writing to the White House saying, no clear effect, more research needed. And then eventually, at least in the poultry industry, they gave up saying that. And it's possibly because the drugs don't work or that they don't need them anymore. I have to wonder how much of it is like tobacco. Tobacco found its big market in the third world. And it's possible that that's where the farm antibiotic market is going right now, which means they'll be generating antibiotic-resistant superbugs in the farms and in the meat products of China and India and Brazil. But bacteria don't respect borders, and so they'll be back here before long. In some cases, they already are.
Let's take a call. We have Jamie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Maren McKenna, the author of Big Chicken.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
This question might be a little bit of a sidebar, but it seems to me back in the days when there was a big snafu about it had to do with prions in cattle's brains, and basically what was happening was they were grinding up cattle and feeding it to them, which has effectively made them carnivores, which spread the situation. Now I ask you, is there something like that happening in the poultry industry? Are chickens eating chickens? And what would be the multiplier effect about that? And Jeffrey, I'll take the answer off the phone.
All right. Thanks for that, Jamie. Appreciate it.
That is a very smart question. Thank you for asking it. So whenever you kill an animal at slaughter, there's a certain percentage of the animal that just isn't useful. Like it's not muscle, it's bone and sinew and guts and things like that. And there's a vast industry called the rendering industry that takes all of that and salvages the usable protein and puts it back into animal feed. Now, Purdue, the company that I mentioned that is based mostly on the East Coast, the fourth largest chicken company in the U.S., which really led the poultry industry's turn away from routine antibiotic use, one of the things they did to make it possible for their chickens to do well without antibiotics was to take animal rendering products out of the diet. So they're very proud to say now that their animals have a vegetarian diet, that they're not eating other animal protein. And this is important not just because it stresses the animal's digestive systems less, which means less need for preventive antibiotics, but also because, as some other researchers have shown, if you are using, as those rendering products, animals that have been given antibiotics and may contain resistant bacteria, the DNA that confers resistance may survive the rendering cooking process and persist in the animal meal that it becomes and so pass on to a new generation. So super smart of your listener for thinking of that.
All right. Thanks for that, Jamie. Back in time to when chicken was really ramping up in the late 50s, early 60s, and the seal of approval began showing up, this chicken is acronized. What did that mean?
I couldn't believe this story when I stumbled across it. And as far as I can tell, I'm the only person to have stumbled across it and sort of brought it back to light. I even asked an FDA archivist about it, and they just looked at me blankly. So this all goes back to Letterly, the company that brought us growth promotion to start with. They seem to have thought in the late 50s and early 60s, so this is a decade after growth promotion starts, that if they could, they were selling all the antibiotic they could to farms to give to the animals while they were alive, but how about one more dose after they were dead? And so they sold licenses to persuade slaughterhouses to dip raw chicken and fish into a solution of antibiotic and then package it. The idea was to kill spoilage bacteria on the surface of the meat in such a way that a package of raw chicken could stay in a grocer's cold cage for weeks instead of for days. And this lasted for about 10 years until, again, it's nicely resonant with what's happening now. People started to become suspicious of additives in their food. This is the time when people are also arguing about DES and cattle and saccharin and so forth, that consumers just turned away from this acronizing, which groceries for about 10 years were really proud to boast of. Our chicken is acronized. And there was a whole Madison Avenue campaign about it.
Yikes. I wonder if it showed up in any of the episodes of Mad Men or something. Acronizing of chicken. You know, by this point in the book, we get a real sense of sort of a bacterial soup that we share with animals. We talked about the microbiome earlier, but I mean, is it that simple? I mean, is there that much bacteria all around us and it's, you know, basically it'll all end up shared at some point?
It is all shared. Yeah, it's a thing that, you know, it's because when I talk about superbugs, when I talk about drug-resistant infections, it sounds like the microbes are attacking us, which is a legitimate way to think about them. But in fact, you know, we live in a microbial world. They are all around us. They are in everything. They interpenetrate everything. And so it's kind of more useful to think not of like war against the bacteria, but more how do we manage our transactions with them? And you can see this not just in this problem of feeding antibiotics to animals, which creates bacteria, which move through the environment, which eventually affect and attack us, but also that those bacteria, you know, spread so widely through the environment that it's not just on meat, but on groundwater and surface water and dust in the wind and on the you know, the feed and the skin and the clothes of farm workers. There's a wide perturbation of the microbial world that happens because we start with this administration of antibiotics where they shouldn't be.
There's another name I want to bring in before we go, and that's Andy Anderson, who worked long and hard to stop the overuse of antibiotics. What kinds of successes did he tally up in his career?
So he really is the person that we can thank. He's, as much as Thomas Jukes is sort of the first inadvertent villain of this story, Andy Anderson is the first hero. He was a British scientist who worked in the 50s and 60s, and he was the one that first really noticed that antibiotic-resistant foodborne illness was rising in England, he worked in London, in a way that had never occurred before. And using the molecular tools of epidemiology that they had at the time, which were not great compared to what we have today, he was able to track these bizarre cases of drug-resistant foodborne illness back through a chain of supply, back to individual drug-using farms. And he's the one that really, through a strategy of science communication that looks very familiar to us now, but was incredibly modern then, of placing articles in different forms of media and so forth, he convinced the British government to move against antibiotic use in 1969 and really started the control of antibiotics in Europe that has put Europe in a very different place in antibiotic use and in the occurrence of antibiotic resistance than we are in the U.S. We're still struggling to catch up.
But it sounds like we're certainly making some efforts now. I mean, the fact that even McDonald's is they put out a release in the end of August indicating the latest steps they're taking in antibiotic efforts with chicken. Don't want to single them out. Other places are doing this as well. But so we're dealing with the antibiotics on one hand, but you know, to take us all the way back to Paris and Poulet Crapaudine, you talked to a farmer who told you they just bred all the chicken out of the chicken. I mean, is that being addressed as well, that we're actually going to get something that tastes like chicken once tasted and still does taste, apparently, in Paris?
Gosh, I hope so. So where we are right now is that in the United States, most of the poultry industry really has responded to these changes. And the first question we have to ask is are cattle and pigs going to follow along behind them? This story is by no means over. It's actually at a kind of fragile moment of inflection, and it's very uncertain what's going to happen next. But my hope is that livestock agriculture turns more and more away from antibiotics, we'll get back to animals that taste better. And the reason is because when you take the antibiotics away, the things that you have to do to animals instead to stimulate their immune systems, which are things like allowing them outdoor access and natural light and exercise and changing their diets and allowing them to, you know, flap around and feed themselves and so forth, all of those things that support their immune systems naturally happen to be the things that bring flavor back to their flesh as well.
Do you eat American chicken at all anymore?
I do. No, depending on my budget, I eat anything from pasture-raised chicken when I can afford it to Purdue. I even go to McDonald's sometimes.
Wow. Okay. a lot to learn in the book. It's really interesting. Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. Maren McKenna, its author, our guest. Maren, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.